This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Harvey Weinstein, Bill Cosby, Bill O'Reilly, Roger Ailes, journalist Mark Halpern, and now actor Kevin Spacey. Allegations of sexual harassment involving these people and others has been all over the news lately, raising awareness of an issue with a long, painful history in the workplace. Women have been speaking out, too, in social media with the hashtag MeToo. Well, let's talk about it. If you have been harassed, do you know what to do about it? What are your rights? Do you want other people to hear what's happening to you? Did HR help you? Was it their priority to protect the boss or to come to your aid? Call in. We want to hear your stories as we talk about what your rights are in the workplace with sexual harassment. The number to call in is 210-614-8980. Email us at thesource@tpr.org. Tweet us at @tprsource. We're joined this afternoon by Rick Giprich. He is the Regional Outreach and Support Program Director for the Texas Association Against Sexual Assault. Also with us is Brittany Chozinski. She is a crisis intervention specialist at the San Antonio Rape Crisis Center. And Rodney Klein is here. He's the Outreach and Education Coordinator for the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission in San Antonio's field office. And our phone line again is 210-614-8980. So Rodney Klein, tell me about sexual harassment in the workplace. The EEOC's job is to do what about that?
Well, obviously sexual harassment is against the law. The civil rights statutes that we enforce, civil rights statute of the Act of 1964, prohibits sex discrimination, and sexual harassment is a form of sex discrimination. So anybody that's being sexually harassed in the workplace, that employer has an affirmative responsibility to make sure that their employees are safe and free from sexual harassment. A person should be able to work without fear of being harassed.
So how do we identify sexual harassment?
There's a legal definition, right? I mean, the behavior has to be unwelcome. It's got to be of a sexual nature. It's got to create what the law calls a hostile or intimidating work environment. And that's a term that a lot of people have heard, but basically that's defined as that the incidents are either severe or that the incidents may not be severe, but they're pervasive enough or frequent enough to create that hostile work environment. And then also that the employer is not taking sufficient steps to address it, or they know about it, they know that it might exist, but they're not taking sufficient steps to address it, to investigate it, and to remedy it.
So does there have to be some sort of negative, like a person lost their job, or they got bum job assignments, or something happens to the victim in this exchange, or just to contact it in and of itself is sexual harassment?
Well, I think both things. In other words, a person can be told, hey, if you want this job, you're going to have to sleep with me. Or the inverse of that, if you don't want to lose your job, you'll have to sleep with me. I mean, that's obviously attaching somebody's job itself to their going through or acquiescing to the demand. Or it could just be that harassment in and of itself, that contact, those incidents do create that hostile work environment, and that affects that person's ability to get their job done. And that's key. That's what makes that a workplace situation.
Rick Giprich at the Texas Association Against Sexual Assault. If a boss tells an employee, if you want this job, you have to sleep with me. And of course, it's never actually, verbalized that way, but it's made clear. Is that sexual assault?
It's more a form of sexual violence. We know that sexual violence is an umbrella term that encompasses a lot of different forms, right? So sexual harassment, sexual assault, rape, child sexual abuse. Depending on how the person perceives it, depending on the situation, and depending on the circumstances that kind of lead into what happens, if that person has to sleep with their boss in order to get that job, it could be considered sexual assault, yes.
Okay, and so Brittany at the San Antonio Rape Crisis Center, do you have clients who come through the center who feel like they've been through a lot, and what do you see at the center?
Sure. So we work with a variety of individuals who have been impacted by sexual assault, from what we call primary survivors, the individual who was themselves assaulted, to secondary survivors, which can be family and friends of individuals, because sexual assault is something that can impact not just the person who is assaulted themselves, but certainly their loved ones and those who care for them. But I think one of the mistakes we make with sexual assault is to think of sexual violence as a single event, when in reality, sexual violence is far more of a continuum. And people are more likely, for example, to intervene in sort of overt cases of serious high-risk violence, but they're less likely sometimes to say anything or to step in what seems like a more muddy or confused scenario,
clear-cut. I hate to cut you off. I just want to clarify some things. I'm sorry to do that. You say so many things. I want to talk about that. So when you say it's a continuum.
Sure.
It means that it's a continuum for the individual. I mean, this is things that it's been one incident after another over a lifetime. And maybe there was a rape and a sexual assault, and now they're in the workplace, and there's sexual harassment, and there's triggers. And so it's not just a wink and a nudge and a pat on the back, but it can be so much more.
Sure. And think of those as incidents that build upon one another. So if, for example, you have someone who is making inappropriate jokes, gendered jokes at work, and the reaction from their colleagues is not to call them out or to say, don't do that, but rather to laugh or to show approval of that, then they build off of that. That becomes a plateau where the next step kind of escalates. So this is something that builds slowly over time, from inappropriate humor to derogatory language to physical touching, perhaps, and can culminate at times in rape or sexual violence, but it's not something that immediately starts at that level. So it does sort of build over time.
And you say inappropriate comments, that includes commenting on someone's appearance.
Absolutely. Gendered comments, commenting on things one wears, how one wears one's hair, makeup, body images, stuff like that.
Okay. And so back to Rodney Klein at the EEOC, you know, how do y'all step in on that? Where's your role on that?
Well, let's say an individual feels like they've been subjected to those comments, just to start off with. And so they sense that something is not working right at where they're at, their workplace, that this is not normal. This is not something that they're comfortable with. This starts creating that hostile environment that may be illegal. They can certainly go to their employer and mention this to the supervisor or to their boss. If it's their supervisor or boss, then most employers have a complaint procedure that allow them to go to other managers or maybe to HR to raise the issue and see if the employer can handle that issue and address it. Now, most people are pretty good judges in their own workplaces. They have an innate understanding whether or not their complaints are going to be heard by management, whether they're going to be heard by HR and acted upon in a professional and respectful way. And so if they don't think that that's going to be the case, then they can certainly come to us and talk to us about the situation. We will give them some information about their legal rights, and if they choose, they can file a charge with our office that we can investigate.
So you're saying that an individual may try to remedy it in the workplace first, if they have a feeling that their HR department is on the up and up.
You know, almost every employer out there is going to have a anti-harassment policy and complaint procedure in place. And we hope that most of those work because they have a legal obligation to do so. And so if an employee feels like, hey, I think my supervisor will, I need to let my supervisor know about this, or I need to get HR involved, then they can certainly try that avenue first.
Okay, we'll talk more about that when we come back from the break. Our phone lines are open. The number is 210-614-8980, sexual harassment and assault at the workplace. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Beyond the often significant emotional and physical and economic harm to victims, there are high legal and financial costs for businesses when there's sexual harassment in the workplace. In 2015, the EEOC recovered $164.5 million through lawsuits filed over sexual harassment charges. So these are very significant costs to businesses, aside from what it means for your employees, people that you should be caring for. Let's go to the phone lines. Number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. Josh is online. And Josh, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Well, I got to criticize you fellas because you're taking a one-sided view. How about the women who, with malice aforethought, try to entice guys into all kinds of situations and then turn around and say, well, I was harassed, I was raped, and blah, 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 and then make a business out of it?
All right, Josh. So let me go to Rodney Klein first. We'll get everyone's to weigh in on that to respond to that comment. Is that an effective business model of women enticing men and trying to trap them into some sort of sexual assault?
Yeah, I don't think I would call that a business model. But, you know, when somebody makes an allegation, I mean, especially at the EEOC, we have to be fair. We have to be even-handed. We're not advocate for one side or the other. We're trying to do an independent investigation. Our findings have meaning only if they are fair findings. And so if somebody makes an allegation of sexual harassment, we have to be able to show that that behavior was unwelcome and that that was negatively affecting that individual's working situation. And the evidence is either going to show that or it's not.
Okay, and Brittany Chowinski from the San Antonio Rape Crisis Center, a reaction to Josh's statement?
Sure. I understand the concern over false accusations or people who are concerned that sometimes women might accuse men of things that they perhaps have not done. But what we actually see in reality is that the majority of women who experience sexual harassment and sexual violence do not report. So we are struggling to get women to come forward and report such things. We have not yet seen any substantial evidence that there is a landslide of women who are making false reports to injure the careers of men.
So I'm looking at some statistics about sexual violence, and it says the prevalence of false reporting is between 2% and 10%. So it's out there, but I don't know if that is the driving force of the conversation. So Rick Giprich from the Texas Association Against Sexual Assault, what do you have to say about that?
When we focus on the fact that women are enticing or that people are enticing folks into this and then crying rape, it distracts from what the real issue is. The real issue is that this happens more often than we can possibly think. The real issue is that things like sexual harassment are precursors to sexual assault. The real issue is that this isn't something that we take very lightly. And I think when we focus on the one, if you had 10 people who made allegations of sexual harassment or sexual assault, and you focus on the one person who maybe lied about it, or it's a false allegation or a false report, what that does is it makes it 10 times harder for those 9 other people to come forth and report it and get support and get help because we focus on just that one. You know, behavior between two people is consensual until it isn't. And that's when the allegations, that's when the reports, and that's when the violence comes in.
So, you know, we're talking about sexual harassment and sexual assault and just, you know, really be clear about what's one and what's the other. Rick, you know.
Well, I wanted to make a comment kind of to piggyback off of what Brittany said about sexual harassment and sexual assault. We have to look at sexual harassment as a precursor to sexual assault. And what I mean by that is in my years of working with survivors at hospitals and responding to cases, it is not uncommon for the survivor to know the person that assaulted them. 87% of women who come forth know the person that did it. And if we just ask that one question about their relationship, about how they felt before this happened, about any kind of harassing or stalking behaviors that they experienced with this one person, we would find, in my case and cases that I worked with, almost half said yes, but I didn't know what I could do about it. I didn't report it. So we need to recognize sexual harassment for what it is and stop it before it escalates. Not every person who sexually harasses is going to commit the crime of rape, but there's a very real potential for it to escalate from one into the other if we don't recognize it and stop it at the sexual harassment level and encourage people to come forth and report it.
But when you report it, I'm worried about retaliation, and that's what a lot of people are concerned about. If I speak up and say, stop it, this is unwelcomed, it could cost you your job in some instances. And so let me ask you, so Rodney Klein at the EEOC, retaliation, do you protect people from that?
Yeah, we do. It's part of the civil rights statutes as well. And just to piggyback on what we were talking about, we've looked at studies that said that 75% of people who have been subjected to workplace harassment don't ever report it. And I'm not talking about reporting it to us at the federal government. I'm talking about just reporting it to their employers. And the number one reason of that is for fear of retaliation. Either something bad's going to happen to their job, or the harasser's going to retaliate in some way toward them as well. But being retaliated against because a person makes a complaint of sexual harassment in the workplace is illegal. And it's as illegal as being sexually harassed to begin with. And these are allegations that we clearly take seriously, because if people could be retaliated against, then no one would ever make a complaint, even, no matter how valid it was. So, yes, that is a big concern and a big issue.
According to these same statistics of sexual violence, 8% of rapes occur while the victim is at work. I assume a lot of that is from, you know, coworkers. How do we see, Brittany, at the San Antonio Rape Crisis Center, how do you see workplace rape at your facility?
In a lot of cases, there's a myth that sexual assault is committed by sort of the stranger in the dark alley, someone who you've never met before. But the reality of sexual assault is that the majority of victims know their attacker. And in many cases, that attacker is in a position of authority over that person. So a workplace would be an example where you have someone in a position of authority over an individual. That can make it very difficult for a person to feel comfortable coming forward, either for fear of retaliation or because they assume, incorrectly, of course, that that is something that they should have to tolerate as part of the job or part of the work experience.
So, okay, you wanted to join in on that, Rodney?
Yeah, we've seen this at the EEOC. We've done some litigation through our agency with farm worker women. And when we see jobs that are in isolated workplaces or in decentralized workplaces, we can see sexual harassment sort of progress or grow in that area. And so farm worker women, whether they're working in the fields, whether they're working in packing sheds, are in very isolated places. And you know that many farm worker women wear bandanas over their faces. And it's not to keep the dust out, and it's not to keep the chemicals out. It's because they don't want the crew leaders to see how attractive they are. Because when that happens, then the crew leader can separate them. And if we're talking about a vulnerable population like that, there's all kinds of ways that supervisor or crew leader can coerce that individual into that act.
And we do see that women in marginalized populations, whether we're talking about women of color, poor women, undocumented women, trans men and women, they are more likely to be victimized, and they can face additional barriers, additional obstacles in coming forward and reporting. So women working in occupational categories like farm workers can be exposed to this at a much higher rate and might feel much less comfortable coming forward given other obstacles in their life.
All right, I'm going to take a phone call here, and our line is 210-614-8980, and Sarah has called in. Sarah, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you. I want to say this occurred many years ago. I worked for a small company that was headed up by a gentleman, his wife, and their son also worked with us, as did the gentleman's daughter from a previous marriage. A little complicated, but I'm pretty sure y'all can follow it. The son was a little odd, to say the least. He had keys to the office, and I started coming into work and finding used condoms in my garbage can. So I went to the office and spoke with his mother about the issue, and she indicated disbelief. So I spoke with his stepfather about the issue. It was so severe that his stepsister asked to be a part of a complaint I made. And this kind of behavior is so disruptive in the workplace that, as a result, the gentleman actually suffered a heart attack and passed shortly after I talked to him. And ultimately, I had to drop the claim because his daughter still had to live at home.
All right, Sarah, thank you for that story. She brings up an interesting point about when it's a family-owned business and then there's family members and, you know, blood's thicker than water, and they're not going to be looking out for the victim. They're going to be trying to frequently, you never make generalizations, but how do you deal with that, Rodney Klein at the EEOC?
In a real general sense, if the you know, we talk about people going back to the employer to raising the issue and making a complaint. But in a sense, if the employer is the one that's doing it, right, and there's no difference between the person that's doing the harassing and essentially the employer themselves, then those individuals can come directly to us and file a complaint that and we will investigate that.
Okay. And Brittany, did you want to react to Sarah's story? I mean, what would someone have done in a situation like that?
So situations of family violence can be incredibly complicated. Sometimes when we think of sexual assault, it's easy to sort of express hatred and disgust at the offender. But when that offender is your son or your father or your grandfather or your uncle or your sister or your aunt, it can be much more difficult for a family member to accept that that person who they love and respect committed this act. So I can certainly understand the caller's frustration, but I having seen cases like that where the offender was someone in the family, I can also understand what that puts a family through to have someone in your family offend like that.
But Rick Giprich at Texas Association Against Sexual Assault. So you have an individual like Sarah makes a call. She comes to her office on Monday, used condoms in her trash can at her desk. That is not just a piece of trash that was left at her desk. That is a disgusting item that's also asserting some sort of sexual dominance in the workplace. But how do you able to zero in and crystallize that this is, you know, beyond the fact that it's disgusting and rude and awful, needs to stop, but there is a sexual violent aspect to just leaving that there?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of at the root of what sexual violence is, right? About power and control. And this person is exerting that kind of dominance and kind of this leaving a trophy, how proud they are of what they did. I think in cases like that, it's traumatizing, specifically for the folks who have to be in that environment. And it makes it that much harder for them to either want to come forth or say something, and not really understanding whether this is something that can be handled criminally, right? Can you report that? Is it a civil matter? You know, and so I think a lot of people just don't really understand, and it leads to this I'd rather not say anything, or I'd rather not do anything.
Because what you're in an uncomfortable position.
Right.
And here you are, you're saying, I want this to stop. Why do I got to deal with this? And you say, how do I vocalize my objection to this? Because this is so weird, you know? And so, I mean, if someone came to you, Rodney, and told you this was going on in my office, what do you do?
Well, as an investigator, I mean, we're going to be looking at that situation and trying to figure out whether there's some sort of evidence to prove that. And
well, there's physical evidence, but you don't want to be collecting that.
Took photos or something, that we don't actually have to have that. But that we can somehow verify or show that that person's allegations are credible. And that's, in essence, what we're looking at. Are those allegations credible? And if we can find evidence to show that, then we're going to find a violation. We're going to try to go in and correct that situation.
And the correction would be what?
Every case is going to be different, of course.
Well, financial?
It could be. There's obviously some remedies that are available to individuals who are victims in the civil courts. But also, too, what we're interested in at the EEOC is injunctive relief. We want to see this fixed. We don't want to see this happen to anyone else. So whatever steps or measures that we can help put in place that will keep this from happening in the future and to make sure that that individual is taken care of at work is something that we want to do.
At least 6 million Texans have experienced some form of sexual assault in their lifetime. 91% of the victims do not report that to law enforcement. Why is that? What can we do to change that? How do we arm people with knowing their rights so that they'll stand up and be able to do things to put sexual violence, sexual assault, sexual harassment in the workplace in its place, which is out of our lives? Give us a call. We want to hear your story. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. You don't have to use your name. We can just call in anonymously to tell your story. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Will the Harvey Weinstein scandal reshape the national discussion about sexual harassment? The scandal rocked Hollywood. It toppled the career of that famous movie producer and is spurring a discussion of misconduct, sexual misconduct, to a new level. Are you a victim? Do you want to speak up? Was there retaliation? Did you lose your job? Well, What are your rights? We're talking about that this afternoon. You can call in. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. And Marie is on the line. And Marie, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you.
Hi.
I experienced sexual assault, not in the workplace, but when I was a student at a small liberal arts college that's affiliated with the church. And it was shocking and very painful. The professor who assaulted me, I considered him kind of a role model, and I was working for him at the time. And it actually occurred two different times. And I finally got the courage to go and speak with the administration to let them know. And they listened. But their only question to me was, are you hiring a lawyer? And, you know, I was young, in my early 20s, and I didn't really have the money to get a lawyer, and was, you know, had kind of felt that that was as far as I could go with it, as far as speaking out. And in fact, all these years later, it's still very hard for me to talk about it, but I have been triggered by the stuff in the news, and kind of made a commitment to myself to speak out when I have the opportunity now.
Marie, I'm glad you did. Thank you so much for calling in, and you bring up a great point about the victimization, sexual assaults on at campus. And Rick Giprich with the Texas Association Against Sexual Assault, what is happening about with protections in that area?
First, I want to say to Marie, thank you for calling in and sharing your story. I know that it's difficult, and what we have to be mindful when we talk about this issue is that this is a trigger for a lot of folks. And so if this conversation, if this show is triggering in any way, just know that there is help. Please call the Rape Crisis Center. Talk to someone. They're there 24 hours a day. To bring up where we are now with campus sexual assault and federal regulations, that's a tricky one.
Well, you know, we're losing ground, aren't we?
We are. In 2011, the federal government, Department of Education, put out a letter that pretty much put all campuses on notice that said, you have to adhere to these sets of guidelines and these
rules. Right,
that's
been called the Dear Colleague Letter.
Exactly, the 2011 Dear Colleague Letter, which is easily Googleable. You can Google that, and folks can read that online, and it is a really interesting read. Now, what's interesting is that this new administration and the new Department of Education Secretary Betsy DeVos has rescinded that Dear Colleague Letter, and so we are left in this state of limbo. So what was put into place and put in policy in 2011 until a couple of months ago when she rescinded that, we don't know where we're going. And that makes it really difficult for survivors. We've made a lot of progress. We've made a lot of strides. Campuses have really been diligent. And I give some of them credit for responding and reacting and being proactive to sexual assault on their campuses. And we just don't want people to go backwards. We don't want people to think that now, because it's been rescinded, we don't have to do anything. So my hope is that campuses continue with their progression, continue with their policies, and make sure that at the root, this is about survivors and making sure that survivors are heard and are protected.
I'm hoping that universities will realize that rescinding that letter is a temporary action, and that trying to use this this new muddying of the waters as some sort of protection against protecting their students is not going to last, and it's not going to serve them very well in the long run, because eventually we will get back to where we were, and they will be held accountable for not taking care of their students. And I wanted to get Brittany's from the San Antonio Rape Crisis Center's reaction to that.
So again, I like Rick, want to thank the caller for coming forward with that. I know how difficult that can be to speak publicly about that. I know that there is always a concern when it comes to sexual assault of seeking justice or seeking some sort of solution, some sort of endpoint to this process. But the thing I like to encourage survivors to focus on is their own healing. So the Rape Crisis Center is, we work with law enforcement, but we are independent of law enforcement. So I encourage survivors to work with a counselor, talk to us, call our hotline. You can do so anonymously if you need to. When you're going through this, when you're working through these feelings, even if it's in the middle of the night and you need someone to talk to, if we sort of put all our hopes of healing on receiving justice in a case. That can be very damaging if justice is not received, as it sometimes is not. So really to focus on themselves and their own healing, make it about yourself. You deserve to make it about yourself.
And Ronnie Klein at the EEOC, what kind of, do the protections that you have in a workplace, does that work on campus between a professor and a student? I mean,
not the laws that we enforce. It's strictly workplace situations. So even though in many respects Title IX is very similar to Title VII, we enforce Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, which deals with employment situations.
Okay. And I'm going to go to another caller. This is Cody. And Cody, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you. So my biggest question is, how do we go about the stigma that sexual harassment or sexual assault can't happen if it's same gender on same gender?
All right, Cody, thank you for that call. And Rip Rich, do you want to address that?
Yeah, it's that's a stigma that we still struggle with every day. You know, even sometimes in our conversation, we have a tendency to just focus on women as survivors. But there are a lot of men who this has happened to as well. And it's just as damaging, just as hurtful, just as traumatic for them as it is for the millions of women that this has happened to as well. Same-sex sexual assault is a problem, and it is an issue, and yes, it does happen. I think it's important for us to recognize and to understand that your voice needs to be heard as well, and that stigma needs to go away.
Yeah, we have a far more difficult time getting men to come forward about this sort of thing. For a lot of men, I think just the way our culture constructs masculinity makes them feel as if they might be less of a man because this happened to them, and that's absolutely not true. So this does happen to men. Women can assault men. Men can assault men. Men absolutely are victimized by sexual violence. And when men do come forward, part of the obstacle they face is not just that sort of cultural construct of masculinity, but a lot of services are kind of oriented more towards women. Now, at the Rape Crisis Center, we do work with men, women, children, so there is no sort of one category that we work with, but it can be a lot more difficult to get men to come forward.
And Rodney Klein at the EEOC?
Yeah, a full 17% of all of the sexual harassment charges we take are filed by men. And sometimes that's because the men are being sexually harassed by women, but sometimes can be sexually harassed by other men. I always like to point this out when I do training with employers, because especially in industries that are maybe particularly one gender, because in the old days we sort of euphemistically referred to that as horseplay. But you know, if that's involving things like touching somebody's genitals or simulated sex, that's not horseplay, that's sexual harassment. And because it is based on sex, that makes it sex discrimination. And so same-sex sexual harassment is illegal.
I wanted to mention something really quickly about the Title IX protections. I think we also think of it in terms of just higher education, but federal regulations apply for K through 12 as well. So these same protections that we talk about when it comes to what happens on our college campuses are also the same protections that we should adhere to when it comes to our kids in elementary, middle, and high school as well.
So Brittany Kozinski over at Rape Crisis Center, are we seeing a change in society where it's more difficult to defend this type of actions? If you're like a teacher at a university and you prey upon women students semester after semester, and you say they're consensual, but you know, you're still using your power and your authority and your position, it's no longer really something that we're I think willing to tolerate as a society.
I certainly hope that's the case, and it seems to be. A lot of sexual harassment and sexual assault really operates and relies upon privacy. So visibility undermines that sort of behavior. And as we're seeing people more willing to come forward, to name the behavior, to report it, to speak out, it's creating an effect where others are willing to do the same. So I do sincerely hope that this is a change in things, and that we will, as a culture, start to speak out against this and to show that we will not tolerate it, that it's not something that it's okay.
We have a comment from Jay on Twitter. The term sexual assault is too often used in instances of lesser misconduct, like H.W. Bush and Kevin Spacey, diminishing its importance. And do you see it that way, Rick Giprich?
Well, I think it's how people define the word sexual assault. And so just so people understand, in the state of Texas, You know, sexual assault is the actual statute. Like, that is what it's called. The act of penetration without a person's consent. That is what we consider in Texas to be sexual assault. Sexual violence for us is the word that we use as kind of the umbrella, as I said earlier, that encompasses a lot of different forms, including sexual harassment. But I think most people don't really understand the general definition of what terms are. So in this case here, in Texas, sexual assault is the term that we use to define penetration without consent.
Okay, so with the President George H.W. Bush, when he grabbed, you know, got handsy with, he laid his hand on a woman and grabbed her against her will and made a crude joke. What is that?
Sexual harassment.
That's sexual harassment is out in the open, and what can you do about that? Allegedly, I mean, he apologized for it, so he admitted it, but you know, he did that to me, and so where do you go with that?
That's a great question. I don't really know the answer to that, but I don't know if Rodney can speak to it. But for me, it's more of a reporting it and letting people know that it can't happen the way that it did.
Okay. All right. We're going to take a break. We'll come back, get some more callers to get on the air. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. The Source continues after this break. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. For decades, organizations, workplaces have carefully crafted their anti-harassment policies and procedures. They've had employee training and anonymous email and phone hotlines for reporting inappropriate behavior. But it doesn't seem to be doing a whole lot of good these days, because we know that sexual harassment in the workplace, sexual harassment out in the world away from the workplace, on campuses, it still is part of life. Have these training events, are they just become like the car alarm in the parking lot where people ignore them and they go about with their inappropriate behavior? What has happened to you? Give us a call. What can we do to try to change this culture? The number is 210-614-8980, and Al is on the line. Al, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi there. Thanks for having me. So I'm calling in, actually, because I'm on the opposite side of things. I was actually accused of harassment by, I guess, a now former friend. Basically, my two closest friends are both female. One of them told me a dirty joke that is only that can only repeat on like HBO or something. I told that joke to my other close friend. She thought it was hilarious. And then I told it to a friend that I had made in class, and I'd only known for about 2 months. And then they apparently dropped the class and filed through the university a sexual harassment claim against me. And so, but they ended up not following through with it. But I'm just wondering, how do you know where to draw the line within your own friend group? As in, you know, which friends will enjoy the, you know, the dirty joke, or and which ones will find it horribly offensive and make them uncomfortable around you?
Okay, Al, thank you for calling in with that great question. So let me throw that to Rick Giprich at the Texas Association Against Sexual Assault. Where are the lines?
Sometimes with friends, lines are blurred. You have to know your limits and your boundaries with your friends, right? And I think having a true, open, honest conversation about what your limits are with your friends is really helpful. I know that sounds really archaic and cheesy. Most people don't do that. But I think the lesson here is asking permission. And if you do something that's inappropriate, apologize for it, ask how you can rectify it, and say, you know, what can I do to be better? I'm sorry that I said that. So I think it's just being mindful of who your circle is and knowing what your limits are with your friends, you know?
And Brittany?
Sure. I think that, as Rick said, knowing your friends and knowing what the limits are with them is important, but we should also probably question the extent to which we need to tell those jokes in the first place.
Yeah, so why even tell them?
Yeah, if there was a really great article published in 2015 in the American Journal of Public Health that looked at how conversations between male peers about real or hypothetical sexual encounters or the use of derogatory language, dirty jokes, et cetera, kind of served as a means of testing the boundaries of what peer-accepted sexual behavior behavior was. So in groups where male peers were more supportive of using derogatory language or telling dirty jokes, what they found is that those individuals were more likely to have engaged in sexually aggressive acts in the past year. So those jokes, when they kind of build over time or when they become a pervasive part of your interaction with your peers, can be sort of a deviancy training where it's reinforcing that aggressive behavior or those views of women.
And so Rodney, and the workplace at the EEOC, which y'all police, that telling these types of jokes, that'll get you in trouble.
Well, I think what it does is it creates, in workplaces, it creates a respect. You have to be cognizant, and that cognizance has to go both ways. One is if I'm being subjected to behavior that I don't care for one reason or another, I need to be able to let that individual know so that they are aware of it. At the same time, I need to be aware of how people are picking up the behavior that I'm giving off. And when somebody says no, no means no. That's a legal principle. But I think Brittany's absolutely right in that there's no place for that in workplaces anyway. And I think what you'll find is that most employers have policies that say, whether that classifies as harassment or not, we don't want to even hear that here. We don't even want to go that direction.
Okay, here's a caller. This is Ashley. Ashley, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you for having me. I just wanted to say a little story. I'm 37, and this incident happened when I was 15. So some time ago, and I was working for Zort, and it was a family-owned business, but the owner, he was the son of the owner, I guess, so he was 30 at the time, I had a little boyfriend at the time, and so he was telling me all the sexual things that I would be experiencing, because I'd never done anything before, and he was just going into detail, and his wife, was trying to stand up for me and telling him, hey, you shouldn't be telling her those things. And he just bulldozed her and started touching her. And he was laughing and thinking it was fun. And she was kind of going against him. But I guess I was a minor. And at the time it was like the culture, and it was one of my first work experiences. So, I mean, the culture was just kind of like it was okay to do that. And it's just, I don't know, that it was just okay, despite it being a family business, and how things have changed to some extent. And I'm really grateful for that, because I look back at that and I don't see how he could have gotten away with that nowadays.
But Ashley, I can hear how this is still very painful for you today.
Yeah.
And so you still live with this.
Yeah, I'm all red just talking about it. I haven't talked to anyone about it before. So.
Well, I'm glad you called in. And so let me go to Brittany about that and the importance of talking about these things.
I think what the caller's hit on is one of the biggest reasons why we don't see these kinds of behaviors reported. They have been normalized to a certain extent through our socialization. We've been trained that this is how men behave, this is how women behave, and part of being a woman means accepting, enduring, or tolerating this behavior, and part of being a man means pursuing aggressively or doing as you will with women, even in public spaces.
This is about power.
It is, absolutely. It's about power, and it's more about power than it is about sex, because it is being displayed in public in that way, in a way that sort of displays that power.
And it's showing you who has the power and who doesn't. You're the powerless one if you're the one who has to endure that.
Very much so. And for the caller who was sort of forced to view that, the power was being exercised not only over the wife, but over the caller as well, who was put in a position where she had to see that. So it's a performance of a sort. It's a performance of power more so than it is an act of sexual gratification.
And not harmless. Something that's like this, these wounds last a lifetime.
Absolutely. For the individual who experienced it, as well as those who had to view it.
Okay, another caller. This is Marcus. Hey, Marcus. Thanks for calling in. You're on the air.
Thank you. I had a similar, I had a situation where I was at work. I was using the restroom, and my supervisor tried to force his way into the restroom while I was using it. He wanted me to leave the restroom. To me, it felt like I was being harassed. Like, sexually, I was in a vulnerable position while I was in the restroom. And so I talked to my other supervisor, asked him if I could make a sexual harassment complaint or what are my rights when it comes to the situation. And instead of pursuing it, they fired me. They said that they told me that that I can't pursue this, that I can't look into it. And I was terminated like 2 days later. I was never written up. I was never laid. I was actually a really good employee. And I got let go. And I'm not sure if that falls under sexual harassment or if it's because I'm a male or because men are just as susceptible to sexual harassment as women. And it seems like when a male says something, they don't listen or they don't care.
Okay, Marcus, thank you for calling in on that. So Rodney Klein at EEOC, you know, you share the bathroom and there, things happen there. And is that where some of these, he has a case?
Well, I certainly would like to talk to him and certainly like to have him come by our office and talk with one of our investigators. If an individual makes a complaint that can be reasonably interpreted as a sexual harassment complaint, then that's a protected complaint. Even if it turns out that we're unable to prove that that's actual sexual harassment, and I couldn't tell from the circumstance whether that would be a sexual harassment case or not, but he made a good faith complaint. And to be retaliated against for making that complaint is a violation of the law. That supervisor that he told has an affirmative responsibility to do something with that complaint and have it investigated, go through their complaint procedures, have that dealt with. In turn, is firing that individual, if that's what happened, then that could very well be retaliatory, and that's something that the law would prohibit.
Well, we hear all the time that HR is more interested in protecting the company than it is in protecting the victims.
Well, you know, in a sense, protecting the company is protecting the victims, because ultimately, you look at some of the things that we see on the news today. Having a superstar harasser or having someone that can do what they want to in the workplace is not a good long-term strategy for business. That it makes more sense in order to have these policies in place and these procedures in place that make sure that the people that are doing your work, the people that you've entrusted to do your work, are being protected.
So if Marcus or someone like Marcus, they want to get in touch with you and make file a complaint, how does that work?
Well, an individual can come to our office. Our office hours are from 8 to 3:30 every weekday except for Wednesday. And our office is at 5410 Fredericksburg Road on Suite 200. And you can come in and talk to an investigator and tell him what happened. And that investigator can talk to him and give him his legal options. And if he would like to, he can file a charge with our office.
And Brittany, at Rape Crisis Center, people can call you up and they can... You know, talk?
Absolutely. We have a 24-hour hotline. It's at 210-349-7273. That's 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. You don't have to give us your name if you don't want to. If you just need to talk to someone, that's what we're here for. If you would like to see us for counseling, we do offer free counseling services. You can give us a call at the same phone number, and we can set you up with that. We're also a great resource just for community resources. If you need to know where you can go or who you can talk to for whichever resource or referral you need.
All right. And Rick Gibridge, thank you also for joining us this afternoon from
thank
the
you.
Texas Association Against Sexual Assault. And this is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for tuning us in.